everybody. Welcome to another Comic Boom Comic Source collaboration. It's your DC Spotlight for April 2nd, 2024. Freshly back from WonderCon, but life is crazy and busy for myself and Rocky as well. So luckily, it's a little bit of a smaller week this week. I would say nothing really jumped out at me as being really bad, but nothing jumped out at me as being really good. But one cool thing was yesterday, I'm just randomly standing there talking to some people on the floor at WonderCon, and I see this guy go walking by, got a black blazer on, got sunglasses on. It's Joe Casey, and he's digging through some back issues, so I went over and said hi.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he recognized me from the interview I did with him about Neil before his in San Diego last year, and I expressed our appreciation of what he's doing with Zod. So he was appreciative of that. It's like, wait, did you already read the next issue? I was like, Oh yeah. I've already read the issue that comes out this week. And yeah, I love what you guys are doing. So yeah, he loved that. He loved to hear that people are appreciating it. So anyway, what did you think of this week overall, Rocky?
I'm glad it was a small week because it's my mom's 75th birthday this weekend. So I spent more of my time visiting with family and friends, and I appreciated fewer comic books to read. But you know, I actually really enjoyed most of the comics I read this week. I enjoyed it. It was fewer comics to read, but I enjoyed a higher percentage of them than I normally do, because usually I'm batting 30 to 40% that I really like. But here there's only two that I thought were meh. I actually really enjoyed this week, so I'm going to enjoy talking about them.
Yeah, fantastic. As far as a follow up for WonderCon, everybody, I'll have a couple of videos out, one of with the cast of Resident Evil, another one talking about some of the Hasbro toys. And then there's maybe thoughts of myself and a few other content creators doing kind of an overview of the show. But we haven't fully decided, because it would be, I wouldn't say negative, but there's concern. The show was so small this year, smaller than LA Comic Con. There's concern. There's rumors that some things behind the scenes at Comic Con International are not so great. So could this be the end of an era? So we're trying to finalize schedules and see if we can get that out for you. But anyway, let's get to the books at hand. Neil Before Zod, written by the aforementioned Joe Casey. Dan McDade is the artist. David Baron on colors. Troy Petrie on letters. Just a fantastic issue. You know, going back and forth with this Neil Before Zod, with what Joe told me at the show, wanting to return Zod to his villainous roots, and then the way Ursa was really being the nagging housewife for Zod. Was he going to kill her? What was going to go on? You know, obviously we saw their son, Lore, leave, and you know, he's over in Sinister Sons now. So really didn't know what to expect. And then with Zod being distraught over Ursa being killed last issue by the Coons, how Zod takes his revenge here, I think, is very telling. He goes up, he attacks the ship that the Coons are on after making some arrangements with the Eradicator, where the Eradicator is actually becoming less powerful, less sentient, less all-knowing. It's interesting. It's almost like a back-to-basics approach from Joe Casey here. You know, you want to talk about getting Zod back to his villainous roots. Let's take away some things, right? Not unlike what Marvel did with Amazing Spider-Man at one time, getting rid of the marriage, what have you. Or you could even say what Brian Michael Bendis did with Superman, briefly getting rid of John Kent and then aging him up, having Superman, you know, not have Lois as a crutch either. So he just had a chance to write Superman. It's a little more problematic, I think, with Superman, only because that characterization has been earned. And I think what Joe Casey feels like with Zod, you know, when he came back and he read it, he's like, wait, you're doing what? Zod's a farmer? Like, what's going on? It didn't really feel like a natural progression of the character. So this back to basics approach, getting rid of he gets rid of the planet. He gets rid of the planet that Zod was on. Again, we can see the desire for revenge from Zod that is so strong that Zod doesn't even care if he survives himself, as long as the Coons that are responsible for the death of Ursa are completely, not just killed, but obliterated, and in a way that they know it's coming. That's one of the other things that's so diabolical about what Zod does. Like, they know they know it's coming, especially the captain of the ship. And everybody else is like, well, what are you doing? Get us out of here, whatever. And the why are you trying to get away? Because the captain knows it's hopeless. Zod is that guy. He has been returned to those villainous roots, and in an incredible way by Joe Casey. It's just such an impactful issue. And like I said, the fact that Zod himself doesn't care if he survives it, as long as he has revenge on these coons that killed Ursa, it just like that says it all. And when the ship does explode, which is a fantastic full page splash from Dan McDade, and you see Zod's body there kind of drifting in space, and then he's captured by somebody, and it does say prisoner in exile. So is he captured by other coons? Is he captured by somebody else? Yellow sun radiation, he should heal from this, but we'll see what comes next. But I can't wait to see. This is Zod untethered. You know, like I said, Lars out there in Sinister Sons, Ursa's dead. He doesn't have the planet to worry about anymore. He's going to have his revenge over those that killed Ursa. So he's going to be pissed off still. He's going to be emotional still. And he's going to be out there with kind of nothing to anchor him. Right, like we talked so much about why Zod was the way he was. Is he not allowed to be happy? You know, Ursa was nagging him about, you know, you're not formidable anymore. You're not, and I'm like, he did the thing he meant to do, right? He did the thing he was meant to do. He's created a new Krypton. He had the planet Kandor, or the bottled city of Kandor there. He did the thing he's supposed to do. He doesn't need to be that desperate anymore. He doesn't need to be that evil guy taking all these actions because he got to where he wanted to be. Why are you still nagging him, Ursa? Well, now he's not where he was. All that has been stripped away by Joe Casey. And even the bottle city of Kandor, he launches off to hopefully a new dimension where they're going to be able to find a home. So literally he has no obligations, nothing to anchor him anymore. It'd be great if we see him as an out and out villain in the pages of Superman again. Just a fantastic job. Joe Casey and Dan McDade are accomplishing exactly what they set out to accomplish with this, which, you know, so many times, you know this, Rocky, they tell us it's one thing and then it turns out to be another. Most recently, I guess, Adventures of Superman, Son of Superman, whatever it was, the John Kent series where we were told it was going to be Ultraman, John Kent versus Ultraman. It turned out to be something completely different. Yeah. This is not the case. We're getting exactly what we were told we were getting, and I love it. So what are your thoughts on it?
You know, it's interesting. I have a slightly different twist on this because I'm not getting exactly what I thought because my expectations were a little different. But I'm not saying I don't like where this is headed, but I have to admit, I wasn't expecting this. This reminds me like a supervillain story. This is absolutely a supervillain deconstruction. It reminds me a little bit of Born Again, but a little bit like it reminds me of a Daredevil Born Again, but for Zod. And there's a part of me that's disappointed in Zod because he gave up. He gave up. He loses his wife. He finds out his own son betrayed him. His own son, Lor-Zod, betrayed him to the Kuns, you know, because Lor-Zod, it was revealed, was captured by the Kuns. And in order to escape the Kuns, Lor-Zod made a deal with them, sent them to the planet. So the Kuns attacked the planet. So Lor-Zod ultimately is going to find out he's responsible for the death of his mother because of the Kuns he sent. So then Zod feels betrayed by his son. His planet's destroyed. His wife is killed. And he's directionless and he loses all ambition to be a leader. He sends off the bottle city of Kandor with the Eradicator to a part of the universe that's unknown. Presumably the Eradicator has a new set of protocols. We don't know what those protocols are exactly. What program did Zod put in the Eradicator? We don't know, but the bottle city of Kandor, the inhabitants in the bottle city of Kandor are in stasis, are in sort of suspended animation. At some point, presumably they're headed toward a planet where they're going to be freed or at some point, but Zod is not going to be among them. And then Zod goes to essentially kill himself did Zod think he was going to survive? Maybe. So maybe this wasn't suicidal. I'm not sure how to read Zod's action. Did Zod, I agree with you that he didn't seem to care. He attacked the Kuns, destroyed the ship. Maybe he didn't care if he lived or died, but surely if he was thinking about it, he'd know he's near a yellow sun. He's got to think that he's likely to survive. So he does that. But then now what? Now Zod is alone. He doesn't seem to, you know, his actions kind of surprised me a bit in a way, because I thought Zod was stronger than this. But the reason why I kind of like it is because it made me realize that Zod isn't as strong as I thought he was. And I don't think Zod is as strong as he thought he was. And I think ironically enough, I think Ursa, I think Ursa is probably disappointed in him from the grave, because Zod is not very strong. I think this is Zod at his most weak and his most crazy. And so now when I kind of got mixed feelings about it, but I give Joe Casey credit, because he's doing, I believe this. I believe that, you know, lose your son, betrayed by your son. He was all about legacy, sending his son off on his son on a rite of passage, just like the Zod family. His son betrays him. Kuns come to the planet, destroy everything. Wife is dead. He doesn't feel like a leader anymore. He probably feels that, what do you have to fight for? I don't know what this guy has to fight for anymore. This can now go anywhere, this story. I don't know where it's going to go. Where did he send the Bottle City of Kandor? What's Zod going to do? Who's capturing Zod now? Does Zod even care? Does Zod have a death wish? I don't know where Zod's mind is right now. And I kind of like it. So hats off to Joe Casey. But part of me feels that this is kind of a significant reset for Zod. And I'm really kind of curious to see where it's going. So I got to admit, I'm still processing the story. I'm still not sure. At first I was off put by it. But now the more it's growing on me in terms of the potential of where this can go. But, you know, I've bitched before. You and I both talked about how we need more villains. I want more villainy. I want genuine evil in the DC universe. And bloody hell, this is what we're getting with Zod. It's clearly we're going there. And I got to say, I'm inclined to like it. So, yeah,
that's interesting that you took it as maybe Zod giving up, because I took it the other way, right? Like I took it as like Zod going, well, shit, I did everything I was supposed to do. I did the thing I was always said that I wanted to do, right? A new Krypton, a new world for Kryptonians that survived the destruction of the first Krypton. I did everything I was supposed to do. I had the wife, I had the kid, I did whatever, and it was all taken away from me. So like, why the hell did I do that in the first place? Like, and I took it as him not necessarily giving up, but him being so blinded by anger, especially that one panel where he's there, the eyes are glowing. He just looks so angry that in a way he doesn't care. He's so blinded by his anger. Yeah. That panel right there. He's not thinking past this action, like this moment of revenge or what. So I don't know that that he didn't care. I don't think he, like, much like we don't know what's going to happen next. I don't even think Zod knows what's going to happen next. He's blinded by his anger. He can't see past.
Yeah.
I just have to kill these coons. So yeah, the next issue will be very telling to see where.
I agree with you. He's blinded by his anger, but at the same time, I did think that he wouldn't be so blinded by his anger that he would. He was in a strategically powerful position. He still had that massive weapon of destruction. He had an entire planet. He could still release the Kandorians and have them as an army on that same planet. He could still have a significant impact on the United Planets, but he doesn't do that.
He built all that up and everything went to shit anyway. So, yeah. I mean, I could see, and I've known, you know, like I did everything I was supposed to do. You know, and I still got screwed. So fuck it. You know, that's not like it's. Don't get me wrong, not a healthy way or whatever. But again, I guess your argument that's a sign of weakness. Mentally, to not be able to persevere through.
Well, let me give you an example of what I mean. I'll give you an example. What I'm saying is Zod was still in a very good strategic position even after this battle with the Kuns. He didn't have to destroy his planet. He didn't have to send away Kandor. He still had that weapon of mass destruction. Why is he doing this? It's sort of like at the end of the Battle of Waterloo, Napoleon was still in a good strategic position to continue the war, but he kind of, you know, some historians say that he sort of gave up, but Napoleon wasn't the same after Waterloo, but he was still in a good strategic position. But he nonetheless, he didn't necessarily have to surrender. Anyways, that's besides the point. That's my point with Zod, is that Zod, I can understand his state of mind is like that, but he's in a relatively decent strategic position. He's just eliminated the Kun fleet. He still has an entire planet, a massive weapon of destruction. He could still go get his son, but instead, what the hell is he doing? And these are the questions I have. And this isn't a criticism. It's an underhanded compliment to Joe Casey saying, okay, you not only got me curious now, you got my attention. So show me where Zod's going to go after this.
Well, maybe it's the selfishness of Zod, right? Like he's still in a position to have it all, but this is a massive setback for him and his ego can't handle it. So he takes his ball and goes home. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if I can't have this, if Ursa's not going to be here, if Lars Zod's not going to be here, then I don't care what happens. I'm going to go scorched earth, you know? I'm only going to have to worry about myself going forward. I don't know. Again, the fact that we're having these discussions and we're intrigued by this just shows the strength of the series. So,
you betcha.
All right. Up next, we have Poison Ivy, number 20. I can't believe almost 2 years of Poison Ivy. G. Willow Wilson is the writer. Marcio Takara is the artist. Arif Prianto on colors. Hassan Osman Elhau on letters. Secret Origin of Pamela Isley, part 3 of 3. This is... it's not necessarily, I wouldn't say like a retconning of the origin, but it's definitely more additive, gives more context. I guess modernization of her origin would be a good way to tell it. And it's DC's way of having their cake and eating it too, right? Like they can still say with this origin, and all credit to G. Willow Wilson and Takara for doing such a fantastic job with this origin, that you can go back and you can read, you know, old Poison Ivy stories before they made her, you know, somewhat of an anti-hero, certainly less of a villain. And you can still sort of reconcile them. You know, maybe there's some sanding you got to do around the edges to make it fit. But the origin they've told here, making her this, you know, eco-terrorist, having her get these powers from an injection from Jason Woodrow and hearing the call from Gotham City as an open wound on the earth and what have you. And there's a scene where she talks to Batman and says, hey, we can be allies. Batman doesn't trust her. Batman's paranoia in full effect. It all makes sense. It makes sense. It's fantastic. This is the way you do it when you want to go back and change things and modernize them. Like Rocky said, we still want villains to be villains. I don't want Poison Ivy to be anything but an out-and-out villain, but I'm not DC editorial. You know, I'm not their marketing department. I'm not their licensing department. I'm not the one trying to sell Harley Quinn comics and what have you. So I get it. I get why they're doing this, and it makes sense. And honestly, it sort of makes Poison Ivy a more interesting character because she's not so black and white. You know, she's not, if you're not a plant, you're evil, I hate you, blah, blah, blah. She's a little more compassionate. She's a little more understanding. We've seen that throughout the series. There's been humans she's cared about other than Poison Ivy just as much as she cares about the plant. So I think this is really, really well done. And if you're curious, if you've never really known the origin of Poison Ivy, you don't need to go back and dive too deep into it. Just read this. Just read these three issues. Get the kind of the current canonical modern origin of Pamela Isley. It makes sense for where the character's at now. And as it has throughout the series, the Marcio Takara art perfectly suits kind of the organic plant-like nature of Poison Ivy and of the story G. Willow Wilson is telling. So, you know, I've said it before with the series, I've never really been a person who really cared about Poison Ivy one way or the other. She's pretty far down on the list of villains that I want to read about. But G. Willow Wilson has made her an interesting character. And man, I look forward to reading Poison Ivy every month. She's done a fantastic job. Who would have thought, you know, like she's mostly known for doing the Kamala Khan version of Miss Marvel over at Marvel Comics, which obviously very different from Pamela Isley, young, a hero, and pretty much on the straight and narrow, you know, like out and out white hat. Pamela Isley, much more complicated than that. And G. Willow Wilson's done a fantastic job. So what are your thoughts on this one, Rock?
Yeah, well, I echo your sentiments. I have mixed feelings about the origin in terms of moving away. They're definitely... given the vanilla flavor version of her origin, the idea that she's not really a villain, she's just really misunderstood. I mean, when she first came, she basically, picking up from the events of last issue, she ends up in she ends up sort of escaping her circumstances with Jason Woodrow, her you know, would-be boyfriend and the gardener. She ends up in Gotham City, where she ends up discovering that she's got pheromone power. She discovers her powers gradually over many months in Gotham City and eventually has her first adventures as Poison Ivy. She doesn't want to say who she is, but the motivation is that she wants to protect her friends. She doesn't want to say her real name because she doesn't want to get her friends in trouble. And then even Batman, you know, the idea that, oh, Batman just, you know, Batman doesn't trust her, because the idea that she wants to work with Batman because Gotham, the city of Gotham and the plant life and the environment is adversely affected in Gotham, and what's happening in the environment is wrong, and she wants to work with Batman, and she actually appeals to Batman. Kudos to J. Willow Wilson. I think to a young Batman, I think if it wasn't for Poison Ivy's past and the fact that she had used pheromones in her first, you know, in her, she was a villain first and foremost when she first arrived in Gotham. And, you know, if it wasn't for that, Batman probably would have put more faith in her and trust in her, because she is a very powerful metahuman. But unfortunately, it was just not to be. Poison Ivy doesn't seem to have a lot of luck with her male relationships, to say the least. And that actually works here. And I often find myself criticizing characters that don't have any competent male relationships. But this one, actually, J. Willow Wilson, over 21 issues, has actually really set this up. And she has managed to win me over that, to say, you know what, if she's not going to be a villain, she's just a genuinely misunderstood, and kind of a screwed up person. But it's understandable why. It's easy to see, especially if you don't have the baggage that maybe you and I have with the character, where we're familiar with Poison Ivy stories, where she's definitely been very villainous, well, and killed people. This is a softer side of Poison Ivy. She's more misunderstood. And to the extent in the past where she's gone full psychotic, you could, if you in your head canon, say, well, it was probably because of all the various chemicals and the plant chemicals and crap that she's been injected to over the years. And so it actually works. It actually works. And I think this series is going to be very, very popular. This is the one comic book where I've got all the physical copies, and I'm glad I bought all the physical copies, and I'm glad I bought all the cover A's. There's a beautiful consistency and flow, visual flow. When I look at my comic box and I look at issues 1 through 20, there's a visual consistency on cover A's, which is rare in comics nowadays, in my opinion. And I don't need the variant covers, although some of them are nice. I just like the cover A's. The art's fantastic. It's consistent, really, from issue 1 through 21. It's very well done. And J. Willow Wilson, kudos to her. She's done a really good job here. And again, there are going to be people that take issue with this, because this is sort of an about face. And it. But you know what? When you think of it, though, it's told from the perspective of Poison Ivy. So if you're taking pot shots at Batman, maybe that's okay. You know, Poison Ivy, we have to allow for the fact that she's an unreliable narrator when she's talking about her own life. Given her background, we shouldn't necessarily judge that and say, well, this is bad writing, not understanding Poison Ivy. This is how Poison Ivy, we're all of us are heroes in our own story, or at least we're misunderstood. And I think Poison Ivy feels that way about herself, and she's very self-effacing about it. And J. Willow Wilson has given her a very consistent and good voice in that regard, and it works. So yeah, another great comic this week.
Yeah, fantastic issue for sure. Okay, up next we have Birds of Prey, number 8. This is from writer Kelly Thompson. Javier Pina and David Lopez are the artists. Jordi Blair on colors, Clayton Callan letters. So interesting that this is a two-parter, basically, because it feels like all setup. It feels like all setup. So interesting. I mean, whoever does a two-parter, how's that, you know, writing for the trade or what have you? So give us your thoughts on this, Rock.
I enjoyed this. I've been enjoying Birds of Prey from the beginning. And this issue, Kelly Thompson sort of teased. She teased this issue 8 in a number of interviews. I might have been, she gave one to you. Did she not? Did you interview Kelly Thompson recently, Chase?
I've interviewed Kelly several times, but not recently. Not since she...
Not recently?
Not since she jumped on Birds of Prey.
Yeah, because I was listening to another interview she gave, and she was talking about this issue, and she was talking about Big Barda. And, well, Big Barda is the standout in this issue. basically, we know from this previous storyline, we know that somebody's trying to kill Barbara Gordon, and the Birds of Prey want to figure out who. And whoever's trying to kill Barbara Gordon has a link. They can both time travel, and they got a connection to the Green. And so that leads them to Vixen. And Vixen owns a fashion company. And they end up at this fashion show. And this is where Kelly Thompson's, her writing really shines. She did this a couple of times when she was writing Captain Marvel. I mean, she's really good at the character work here. And we get some new characters. We get, I mean, Big Barda and all the Birds of Prey in just gorgeous, sexy outfits with a bunch of beefcake men standing around. And literally there's whoever the villain is behind all this, they're mind controlling apparently the male models through the clothing. And Big Barda misunderstands. She thought it was her clothing. And she ends up naked at one point. I'm not going to do it justice, but it's funny. The dialogue is it's fun to read. This is a fun read. I mean, at one point, even Meridian is going around, or Sin is going around, and she's actually the caterer, catering to all these older people as they're watching this fashion show. And it's the dialogue that makes, you know, not a heck of a lot happens. But the dialogue makes this enjoyable and fun to watch. It's just a fashion show gone awry. And it really is a great page where Big Barda's naked and it's got Big Barda's head right where her bum cheeks are. It's actually very well put together. And it's funny. It's enjoyable. And I think people are going to just love this issue. I agree with you. It's set up. This is the second issue. This is a two-part setup story. It ends on a major cliffhanger because Barbara Gordon, despite the best efforts of Black Canary, Barbara Gordon ends up being sort of sucked into pulled into a vortex. And then at the end, it looks like all the Birds of Prey are going to follow or are going to go after her, of course, because they don't want anything to happen to her. But I thought this issue covered the whole range of emotions from humor and fun and sexiness and, you know, where the, you know, beefcake men, beautiful women, humor, good, great dialogue. And then at the end, you got some sorrow and sadness as they watch Barbara Gordon get sucked in this vortex as Batgirl. And it's emotional because Black Canary feels she's failed her. But Black Canary turns back to the birds and say, you know, under no circumstances are any of you to follow me, because she's not going to let Barbara be alone. And so she jumps into the vortex too. And of course, all the Birds of Prey heroically just, they don't even give it a second thought. They walk toward the light because they're, you know, you don't leave no bird behind, right? And I thought it was just great. I thought it was really well done. And it's, again, I love the issue. And I love the art. Javier Pina and David Lopez were the artists. I thought it worked really well. In fact, and the color work as well. The color work was less muted in this issue, which I really liked, because I know it was a little bit muted in some of the early issues. But this here, I thought it worked really well, the color work. And I liked it even more because of this, we got the birds in bikinis and sexy outfits, and given what the issue was about, I thought it worked really well. And again, just another issue that I liked. I just, you know, thank you, Kelly Thompson, man. I mean, I really enjoyed it. What about yourself?
Yeah, the Jordi Belair color work is fantastic. What's so interesting? So Birds of Prey is a property that's so much about, or at least as much about, the relationship between the different women as it is about whatever their mission is, right? One of the great things that Kelly Thompson's done is she's kept up with kind of that theme and that idea behind Birds of Prey, where it's so much about the relationship, especially between Barbara and Dinah. And you can see that, right, with how much she won't say, hey, make sure Batgirl stays outside. We want to make sure nothing happens to her, whatever. And then Black Canary following her and telling the other, wanting to keep the other Birds of Prey safe, hey, don't follow me. But the other thing that Kelly Thompson has done, while keeping that central idea that this book is really about the relationship between these women, she's brought in women that haven't been in the Birds of Prey before, so we can then explore new relationships between these female characters. Characters like Harley Quinn in the first arc, who hasn't been, Birds of Prey before, and Big Barda, who steals this issue as Rocky mentions, he's fighting nude. That's fantastic. Maps Magucci, as much as everybody rails against John Kent being aged up because we were just sad about it, all the stories we missed out on, Maps didn't show up anywhere near as often, and we're still getting Maps stories for that matter, because Kelly did it the right way, right? It's a Maps from the future coming back. So we have lost nothing with Maps. We can still have all those stories of Maps in her formative years. But yet we have this future Maps, this Meridian character, where we're getting to see her aged up. We're getting to see her as maybe a tangential Birds or of Prey member or reserve Birds of Prey member. And again, exploring those relationships and the complexities of the way these characters play off each other. That's where this series shines. That's where it's really important. Correct me if I'm wrong, Rocky, but I don't think Vixen has been a Birds of Prey before. I don't even remember her showing up in a Birds of Prey comic. So,
She hasn't been, not to my knowledge, no. Yeah, I mean, I think she may have been in a Birds of Prey comic, but I don't really recall her being a Birds of Prey. But
she's not a member of the team, but I don't even know if she's showed up in a Birds of Prey comic before. But again, a powerful, important, formidable female character in DC. I mean, she would have been the first DC heroine to have her own solo title if it would have been for the DC implosion in the late 70s. So she's an important character, and she was a big part of the Detroit era Justice League, and I really enjoyed her there. So again, great to see her in these pages, great to see her showing up, and it's just fantastic to see the heart and the humor and the interactions between these different female characters. Kelly Thompson's a perfect writer for it. So, just a fantastic issue all around. All right. Up next, we have Batman 146, written by Chip Zdarsky, art by Jorge Jimenez, colors by Tameo Morey, letters by Clayton Cowles. I don't think I'm going to have a whole lot to say about this, so I'm going to let Rocky go first. But my one little nitpick before this was kind of just a meh issue for me, but one thing that I will complain about, as I often do when this happens, the title page is page 11. It's not in the front. It's not in the back. It's page. Stop doing that. Give me the title page within the first two pages or put it all the way on the last panel. Stop with this credits on page 11. That's literally almost halfway through the book.
What are you doing? I'm trying to find it.
I can't stand it. I hate it when they do that. I can't stand it. So anyway, give us your thoughts on the issue.
Well, a lot happens in this issue. A lot happens. It's actually Zdarsky's going all in on this. He's going all in on this Batman of Zur-En-Ah thing and Zur-En-Ah and the history of how Zur-En-Ah's master plan the Joker's plan with Kaptiuk, Dr. Kaptiuk's plan was to have the Joker continue to berate Batman, to continue to push the psychological limits of Batman so that eventually Zur-En-Ah would manifest and take over. And Zdarsky does his level-headed best to try to fit it into existing Batman continuity, in particular Scott Snyder's run, quite frankly. And I think he does a reasonably competent job. I mean, it's okay, I guess. It's revealed here that the Joker apparently was the one who said it, who kept sabotaging the Penguin, and that ultimately led to the Penguin being basically banished from Gotham and his children being sort of taken over the Gotham underworld. Meanwhile, Kaptia was always working behind the scenes to ensure that Dr. Kaptia had sort of almost had given the Joker a safe word so that if ever Batman was beating the hell out of him, he could tell Batman the safe word. And the safe word was Arco Tenebris. And so the moment Joker would say that to Batman, Batman would freeze, and that would cause Batman and the Joker could tell Batman, okay, now pull me to safety. So it leads one to believe that all those times we wonder, how did the Joker survive? he actually survived because Batman saved him, or that Batman did something, because the Joker always had this safe word that Dr. Capdia had sort of planted in Bruce Wayne's head that could activate Zarina or somebody to rescue, or Bruce Wayne to give Joker some semblance of control. At least that's how I kind of read it. Thought it was interesting. Capdia confronts Bruce Wayne as Batman here. Not surprisingly, Bruce calls Capdia, you know, like a narcissistic psychopath who's just in this to because it's a game to him. He wants to see how far the Joker's going to take it, how far Batman's going to take it. He's just more like he's an interesting. It's like a science experiment for Dr. Capdia. He likes sort of pitting the Joker and Batman off against each other. Meanwhile, we all know that ultimately Failsafe is going to be one of the trio of villains in absolute power with Amanda Waller and Queen Brainiac. Well, this is before that, and we've got Failsafe, who the rest of the Bat family does not know if Failsafe. They think that Bruce Wayne might actually be in control of Failsafe, because they think that maybe Batman's physical body is dead, but his consciousness is uploaded into Failsafe, and Failsafe is actually working with Damien. Damien is working with Failsafe, and Failsafe is not killing. He's apprehending bad guys. That includes Punchline. That includes Harley Quinn. And by the way, I agree with that. I think Batman should have thrown Harley Quinn in prison a long time ago. Same with Punchline, the whole nine yards. There's some things that I will agree with Failsafe. I will agree with Zarina with, as opposed to Batman. Harley Quinn, I don't care. You can be reformed all you want. I don't care. You still got a lot of murders that you got to pay for, and you should be spending the rest of your life in prison. Sorry. So I don't mind that as much as I still love Harley. But anyways, Punchline showing up, I thought was a nice addition, because it's interesting. Batman, somehow Dr. Capdia has somehow incredibly managed to take over Blackgate Prison, and no one in the United States seems to care. Of course, how can Amanda Waller do what she wants? It's that you got to suspend your disbelief. You know, not even the mayor of Gotham can do anything about it. Dr. Capdia controls. He's the warden now. He's of Blackgate. And now Failsafe controls Blackgate. And he's putting all these prisoners in Blackgate Prison. And he's going full no holds barred. He's throwing Harley Quinn, Punchline, all the villains, Killer Croc, all the stuff he's putting in prison. And Batman, of course, wants to break out. And Batman realizes that he can meditate, and that if Zarina has all his memories, Batman discovers, not surprisingly, that if he meditates, he also has Zur's memories. So he now knows what Zur knows in terms of how Zur did everything, because it was just locked in the recesses of his mind. So he accessed that part of his mind. So I like that. I like that Zardaski's given Batman here finally some level of competence, because Batman has continued to be beaten down from Gotham War into this. Batman has looked surprisingly incompetent on a number of levels, notwithstanding the fact that he can survive a fall from the moon. He still should be a little bit more competent. Finally, there's a little bit more competency on Batman's part here. I kind of like that. Batman tries to he tries to escape. He, on the surface, it appears he's successful in escaping Blackgate Penitentiary. And meanwhile, Damien has come across some other robots, some different designs, and a Mazo design. And Damien is beginning to question Failsafe's motives and method of operations, and so the seeds are being planted here for what should be a very interesting absolute power. And at the end, we have Superman. The Justice League is worried about Superman. Confronts Batman, saying, "Hey, Failsafe/Batman," and because he's not sure, because Failsafe hasn't done anything wrong yet. He hasn't broken the law per se. Hasn't killed anybody. He's just been hard ass, but hasn't done anything wrong. And Failsafe says, "Well, you know, just stay out of my way. Everything's fine. I'm doing what I always do." And so far, he's right. And so there's this uneasy relationship between Batman and the rest of the Justice League. And it's believable. It's believable. So, and it's quite easy to see that before the SHIT hits the fan, absolute power will be with us. And Just a quick aside, I'm, of all the aspects of absolute power, I'm more interested in Failsafe as being one third of that trio of villains than I am with Amanda Waller or Queen Brainiac. I'm really curious. I'm really, that excites me. So this actually, this storyline excites me, and I enjoyed this issue too. And I don't know what it is if I'm just in a good mood because it's my mom's 75th birthday this week, but meeting family and friends, and I've had a good weekend. I've been in a good mood reading these comics, but I really enjoyed this comic. I'm really curious to see where it's going. So what about yourself? Oh, you're on mute there, my friend. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry about that. You definitely get a sense of what Zdarsky's trying to do. You mentioned, you know, tying this in with what Scott Snyder did. Clearly, Snyder's run has influenced Zdarsky tremendously. Yes, you're right. You have to sort of suspend your disbelief for a few of the things. You wonder why, and at least Zdarsky tries to explain, right? Hey, here's why the Justice League isn't getting involved. Yeah, Captillo taking over Blackgate Penitentiary. I guess we just have to chalk that up to the guy being able to be a master manipulator or what have you. We were wondering how Captillo survived all that time. We were talking about last issue or the issue before, all that time in captivity. Great to see Zdarsky address that. You mentioned it, the Joker safe word or what have you. Batman didn't even know he was doing it. So, yeah, I mean, it's a good story. I could see how it could rub some people the wrong way because it is a bit of retconning. How could this be going on? How could Batman not be aware or what have you? But I'm willing to set all that aside and just say, hey, this is interesting what Zdarsky's trying to do because, you know, we mentioned getting Zod back to basics. In a lot of ways, Bruce is back to basics, right? Like he's got nothing. He doesn't even have a shirt. Doesn't have his utility belt. He has his cowl. He has his pants and his boots and his gloves and a truck he stole apparently. And somehow he's going to have to defeat Failsafe, even though Failsafe has defeated him time and time and time again. You could argue that's a little bit of an ex deus machina that he came to that realization that, hey, if I stop and meditate, if Zur-En-Aa and in turn Failsafe know everything in my mind, they came from my mind, I should be able to access that in some way. So it's probably just a situation where not enough real estate, not enough space in the comic to really flesh that out more. It's an important moment and perhaps a turning point in the story. And it's easy to miss because it's just a couple of panels. It's not even, I mean, again, I'm sure it's an issue of real estate, but having a big montage piece might've been better. You could have had Bruce's face, you know, in the center and then everything, all these different Failsafe or Zur-En-Aa plans or him building Failsafe or something kind of around it. So it really hit, because I think it is a key moment and it could be missed by some people. But we'll have to see. I mean, I'm sure Zdarsky will reference it more as the story moves forward. So as much as I'm not a fan of the Joker, not a fan of what we've gotten so far with tying in Bruce's origin and the Joker origin so closely and Captillo being kind of the link that ties them together, I have to admit what Zdarsky's doing is interesting, and I feel like it is additive to the Batman mythos, so we'll see how it all plays out. As far as the art goes, you know, Jorge Jimenez, fantastic artist, I think, certainly loved his work on Super Sons. This is a grittier style that he's doing here. It makes sense why he would do a grittier style. It is Batman. That being said, I don't enjoy his art. I didn't enjoy his art on Gotham War. I haven't enjoyed his art here as much as I enjoyed it on Super Sons, where it was a bit cleaner. Even his Justice League run with Scott Snyder, where things were a bit cleaner. But again, you can understand why he's making it a little more gritty, a little more visceral, a little more textured in this story, because you know that's what a story set in Gotham calls for. I also appreciated Zdarsky kind of explaining, you know, going all the way back to the beginning of his run, explaining the motivation for the Penguin and tying that in with everything. And it's really one of those situations where everything Zdarsky's done has been one long run, not so dissimilar from what Tom King did. But I think the difference is that Zdarsky's run is paced so much more quickly. And it's something I think probably traditional Batman fans are enjoying more. Because it's Joker Batman as opposed to Batman Catwoman. I think you get more people that are interested in Joker Batman than you would Joker Catwoman. So again, I think Tom's run got probably more grief than it deserved. But again, I think what Zdarsky's doing here is very inspired, and it's not a bad idea to take inspiration from one of the most beloved recent runs on Batman, which was Snyder Capullo. So he's smart to do that.
That's true.
Up next, we have Suicide Squad Kill Gotham, issue number 3, written by John Layman. Art is by Jesus Hervas. Colors by David Barron. Letters by Ann World Design. This is a Harley-focused issue. This is the Harley from the video games. So if she doesn't behave the way that you might think Harley should be behaving in the regular issues, she's still very villainous here. That's why. I do appreciate the humor that Layman injects here or there when he can. If anybody knows John Layman, he has a pretty good sense of humor. He's a great guy to hang out with. But I'm not that familiar with the video games. There are references here to other events that have happened in the video games in the past. So that kind of, I appreciate that there's editor's notes telling me about these events, because otherwise stuff just goes right over my head. I'm not going to play any of the Arkham Knight games anytime soon. So, or ever probably. So I appreciate that. I didn't get a lot out of this issue though, because again, I don't have that context. And I'm not the biggest Harley fan, especially this kind of version of Harley where she's out and out villainous. And not that I'm a fan of her as an anti-hero either. I prefer the very cerebral Harley, and this is certainly the zany, crazy Harley. But the art is fantastic. Tons of action. It's fast-paced. And those bits of humor are enjoyable. But for me, just because it was focused on Harley, not my favorite issue of the series so far. But I am curious to see where it comes next, because a lot of these issues have focused on specific villains. Last time we got kind of the Will Smith version of Deadshot. We got Deathstroke as well. So I did appreciate that. So we'll see who it's focused on next time. I am curious. It is a technically very well done comic. Just for me personally, just due to my kind of not dislike, but just kind of my apathy, I guess you'd say, toward this kind of version of Harley Quinn. This one was just okay for me. But again, the art, color work, pacing, technically a very well done comic. So what'd you think of it, Rock?
I really enjoyed this too. I know. I feel like I'm handing out high scores just for like Halloween candy this week. But first of all, I love this version of Harley. I because this is the type of Harley that first of all, the cover is fantastic. The cover A by Dan Penelsian, just fantastic. I think it just pops off the. I might even buy two of these two copies of it. I just absolutely love it. It looks fantastic, but not necessarily. The plot doesn't progress a lot this issue, because what happens is last issue we saw the story in many ways from Deadshot's perspective. Who ends up, we think, we being taken out by Deathstroke. And here we get 10 minutes before, we see the same events, but from Harley Quinn's perspective, and she ends up ultimately saving Deadshot from being finished off and his head smashed in from a guard. But we get it from Harley's perspective, and there's a lot of there's so much violence in this issue. I know. There's a lot of part of the controversy surrounding the video game, and I don't play the video game either, but I actually watched the story of the video game. I loved it. I loved the violence against the Justice League. I didn't care that Green Lantern got peed on and he got humiliated. I don't care. I don't care that Wonder Woman was the one to survive, or Superman ended up, all this stuff. It was fun. It was I thought it was a great story. The video game, it was a great story. I don't care what anybody says. It was fantastic. I thought it was really good. And it was ridiculously violent. And it's called Suicide Squad Kills the Justice League. And I say again, anybody who's offended by the fact that the Justice League died, why did you buy the video game that's called Suicide Squad Kills the Justice League? Anyways, I won't rant about that anymore, other than to say that there's a lot of violence in this issue. A lot of the villains died. The Ventriloquist is killed. There's multiple villains that are are actually taken off the playing field, and that's what I like. There's waterboarding, there's torture, there's limbs being ripped apart. I mean, this is graphic violence. This is almost Black Label stuff. This is not really for teens. If you want to get this is exorbitantly violent, and you got Harley Quinn popping jokes. Harley Quinn, psychoanalyst, Harley Quinn is figuring all this stuff out. Harley Quinn is thinking. You can tell she's intelligent, but you can also tell she's psychotic. And I think part of the reason why I always like a Harley Quinn, that part of her psychosis is that it's precisely because she has a psychosis that she doesn't suffer PTSD. She knows how to adapt to any situation. That's how how screwed up this woman actually is. But damn, if it doesn't work for her, and she just incorporates it. I mean, in many ways, there might be similarities with the Joker, but Harley Quinn is one step better than the Joker, because Joker is always driven by an obsession with Batman. Harley Quinn is driven with an obsession for happiness and joy in life, even if it involves exorbitant violence. And this is what it is. One of my favorite scenes in this issue is when Amanda Waller is watching on the video screens, and they can't believe that Harley Quinn actually survives an attack by because she has no powers. How can she possibly survive an attack from one of their armed guards? And they watch in horror as she literally dismantles them, and they don't even show it. What is so funny is that in the scene, you see Amanda Waller and this other personnel member looking in disgust. You see their faces in disgust, but you don't see what Harley Quinn's doing. And what's funny is there's grossly violent acts. They show a guy being ripped apart earlier in the issue. So you get to this scene and they won't even show you what Harley Quinn is doing, but they are just showed you a disembowelment four pages before. So it makes you wonder how violent is Harley Quinn. Anyways, I thought it was fun. I don't know. This comic is exactly as advertised. It's consistent with the video game. Again, the story in the video game. I haven't played the video game. And I don't, the writer, you're going to have to refresh my memory. The writer is John Layman. He knew the assignment. He knew the assignment, and he's done a really good job. And again, that cover A, I love that cover A. So again, I'm going to have a hell of a time picking my pick of the week this week. I've so far, I'm bat every single one of these I liked.
All right, well, let's move on to Shazam number 10. I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on this one. Written by Josie Campbell, Emmanuel Lupacchino, and Mike Norton are the artists. Tris Mulvihill on colors, Troy Petrie on letters. I would say, since Mark Waid left the title, it's lost a little bit of its charm and its kind of simplicity. And part of its charm, I think, was this simplicity. It feels much more chaotic now, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, because Josie Campbell's introducing a lot more sort of plot threads and plot points, and she's still kind of playing out some of the things that Mark Waid established, relationships with Zeus and gods and what have you. So that's all well and good. And also some of the struggles and maybe disconnect between Billy Batson persona and the Captain Marvel persona. Obviously, stuff with the family, which is at the heart of any Shazam story. All of that is still working. The art is still really, really good. But again, just very chaotic as opposed to comparing it to what came before. That's not, again, not necessarily a bad thing. Just something that I noticed. So it's going to probably take a few issues to kind of get a feel for what the series is going to be like going forward. But one of the things that Campbell's doing very well, kind of following the footsteps of Mark Waid, is very continuity light, right? Like, you don't need to be reading anything else to be reading Shazam Family or what have you. So I am enjoying this. Again, I thought the art was really strong. And the thing that intrigues me most and I'm most curious about is to find out what's going on between Billy and his persona as Captain Marvel, or the Captain, as he's come to refer to himself. So what were your thoughts on this one?
I thought it was well done. I thought it was well done. I would actually prefer more solo adventures with Billy Batson and the Captain Shazam. But I understand what Josie Campbell's doing here. And clearly Mark Waid, she's taking the reins from Mark Waid. I think she's very clearly finishing the storyline that Mark Waid started. And that is the fact that it's kind of funny. This issue has, we we're introduced to a new character named Bull, a potential love interest for Billy Batson or possibly Freddy. And Billy receives a letter, a mysterious letter, and he sort of like has a moment where he sort of blacks out a little bit. And who is the letter from? We're not sure. Meanwhile, Zeus has in a battle between Shazam and Black Adam, the orphanage, the house was destroyed, and Billy Batson Shazam asked Zeus for help to rebuild it, and they did. Of course, if Zeus rebuilds the house, there's always going to be a catch, and different rooms, you can access different dimensions, and it's kind of a cool concept. To oversimplify it, each of the members of Shazam, or each of the gods of Shazam, Zeus and Solomon, et cetera, they can have different parts of the house form a different dimension, or you can enter a different dimension representative of Zeus, representative of Solomon, representative of Heracles or whatever, of the powers of Shazam. And that's interesting. A lot of story potential there. We finally have an acknowledgement. Zeus at one point says that he died. And we still don't know how Zeus came back, but kudos to Josie Campbell to at least acknowledge that Zeus, in fact, died. And he was killed by his wife. Is he still married to Zeus, or is Zeus still married to Hera? I mean, it's a perfectly dysfunctional relationship. I mean, if your wife tries to kill you, why not stay married to her? I mean, especially if you're a Greek god, right? But there's a lot happening here. There's a lot happening on the page, and Josie Campbell, I think, is, you know, she took this, you know, she's having a lot of fun with this. There seems to be a creature that also the various dimensions that now form part of the house in just like when Billy Batson utilized part of the Rock of Eternity is grounded in the house, in this house now. And using the same principle, Zeus said, well, if part of the Rock of Eternity, if Billy Batson can access parts of the Rock of Eternity from the house, why can't he access part of my domain and what have you? And that's kind of what he does. But apparently it attracts other creatures as well. And this creature ultimately is probably end up going to return, but they ultimately manage to push this creature away. And will the creature return? We don't know. The issue ends with the captain, Shazam, throwing away the mysterious letter that Billy Batson received. And it seems to suggest that maybe Billy Batson doesn't know that Shazam is burning the letter, which is very interesting, because I always thought that Shazam and Billy Batson, I always thought they had each other's memories. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but you know, because it poses the question, what is the psychological makeup of Billy when Billy Batson turns into Shazam? When he's talking, is he not Billy Batson?
Basically the same person, just a different body.
Yeah. Or is the captain a living different entity? I don't know. Like, it's almost as confusing. Is this like a Batman Zurinov thing, but on a more friendly basis? I don't know. So this is intriguing. So I got to say I'm actually interested in that. I think, well, that's sort of throwing the mythology, throwing it a curveball. And I actually find it kind of interesting. You know, what is that relationship like? Because I think of it this way. Remember what they did with Thor? And I'm not an expert on Thor, and I don't want to upset Marvel guys watching. But I remember Thor and Donald Blake. Donald Blake would always hit the cane and he turned into Thor. And I always wondered, well, is Thor Donald Blake, or like, who is, but now Thor's a different entity. Is he separate than Donald Blake? So are they going to do the same thing with Shazam and Billy Batson? Or are they going to separate them at some, you know, is this the beginning of a major shift? I don't know, but I'm curious as hell again. And so while this wasn't one of my favorite issues of the week, it was a good one. I enjoyed it. And it ends on a cliffhanger that it's keeping me glued. And you know, I'm Josie Campbell. Good job. I enjoyed it.
Finally, one you don't have to consider for your book of the week.
Yeah, but it's still good, though. I want to give compliments to her because it was still pretty good. But a lot of competition this week, in my mind.
Yeah, 100%. All right, up next we have Superman 78, The Metal Curtain, issue number 6. This is the final issue, written by Robert Venditti, art by Gavin Goodrey, colors by Jordy Belair, letters by Dan Lamphere of A Larger World. While I enjoyed the end of this, and it was very much in keeping with the tone throughout, one of the things that we've both mentioned, this is a very simple story. And again, I won't hold that against Robert Venditti, who's one of my favorite writers, but I when you think about the stories that we have in the Christopher Reeve universe of Superman, or Christopher Reeve version of Superman, they are sort of very simple stories, a little bit of their time. You wonder, you know, had he not tragically had his accident and passed away, if there might not have been an evolution of those stories where they got a little bit more complex. Because I think nowadays audiences and people that read comics, the expectation is for stories that are a little more sophisticated and aren't so black and white. But again, this is of its time. It's set in the Cold War. Superman's the good guy, and this evil Soviet Union version of Metallo is the bad guy. And the way everything is resolved is Superman doesn't beat Metallo in any sort of physical way, because Metallo has kryptonite and kryptonite powered, and technically he could kill Superman, but he reaches him on a philosophical level. And the way Venditti presents that is they're fighting in the middle of Moscow. Damage is being done and people are being put in danger in Moscow. And Superman, despite the fact he's being attacked by Metallo, and it's going to, you know, probably cause him pain because he's not engaging with Metallo. Instead, he's stopping to make sure that the people of Moscow are safe. When he gets knocked into a pillar, he makes sure that the people that are hiding on the other side of the pillar are safe. When he gets knocked into a side of a building and the building starts to crack, he keeps it from collapsing, even though it means that Metallo is going to get a free swing at him. And so when he points these things out to Metallo and says, hey, your leaders have lied to you, again, with the perspective that we have, hindsight's 20/20, we know communism didn't work. We knew, found out about all the corruption. Not that we didn't have our suspicions already, but we found out about all the corruption after the collapse of the Soviet Union. We understand what Metallo learns in this issue, and we, take it for face value, what have you. But again, a very sort of Christopher Reeve version of Superman way to reach Metallo. But I think for some people, it may not land with the same kind of impact, right? Because you think about, well, if this really was a film, you want that, big battle and Superman to emerge victorious in some sort of physical way. It's not so unlike the way that the Gal Gadot version of Wonder Woman wins the day in Wonder Woman 2, where she kind of appeals to everybody's sense of belonging and sense of love and, caring about each other rather than beating Maxwell Lord in some sort of physical altercation or what have you. And we all saw how well that went over. Really, this movie was really not well received. So again, I think it works for this version of Superman, but I can see both sides. For me, this is just a fun trip down, a Christopher Reeve memory lane. And it does make me sad what might have been. But anyway, I thought it worked. It was enjoyable. Although maybe if I have any nitpick, Superman reaching Metallo and Metallo's sort of turn, it did feel a little bit abrupt. But again, I can understand why it was done the way that it was. So for me, this worked. Although I don't think it was as strong as the first volume of the Superman 78 that we got. So what were your thoughts on it, Rocky?
I share your sentiment. I'm just going to add the comment that, it occurred to me as I was reading it that the first thing occurred to me is that I thought it was a little bit simplistic, even juvenile. But then I scolded myself a little bit because I thought to myself, what's happening in the world right now? How many Americans and Canadians and how many of us, how do we feel about Russian people right now? How do we feel about Ukrainian people right now? How do we feel about Israel's and Hamas? You know, war is happening in the world right now, and a very dangerous set of circumstances exist on the international stage right now in multiple ways. And this, it's always the most simplistic answer, that's the most important. Love is all there is. And at the beginning, we have this young child who's in danger, and Superman is right there. And what does he say? It's going to be all right. And what does he say to the Russian people? He's there. He's saving Russians as a Russian agent wants to kill him at the command of this at the Russian government. Superman doesn't judge the Russian government. He doesn't judge the people. He saves them. He's there to help. I mean, that's what it's all about. And you know, again, I know I'm probably sounding a little bit melodramatic, but not anymore. I'm equally melodramatic as this story is simple. And I think in that way it works because that is the message. And this is the message that, you know, part of me, I'm scolding myself and maybe I'm politely scolding you. It's like, well, you know what? Maybe it's simple, but maybe we need to hear it because right now there's an awful lot of people that I'm pretty sure that we think Russians want peace just as much as we do. And I'm pretty sure the Russians know what propaganda is as much as we do. And, you know, and what is the truth? What isn't? Well, you know, actions are louder than words. And at the end of the day, Superman does one thing when he's in doubt, and he's rarely in doubt. What does he do? He helps people. What does he do when he's in doubt? He saves everyone, you know, rather than just, you know, pick. No, he saves everyone because that's the easiest choice to make. Help people. And that's the message that I get from this. And it is a good story. It is a little simplistic, but you know what? Venditti understands the assignment, and it's absolutely true to the Christopher Reeve and the movies and that genre and that feel, like you said before, about the movies. And so it works as well. It's it's had heavy competition this week. It wasn't my favorite, but I do really much appreciate the message, the simple message that I think the world right now needs to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree at all. And the other thing is, you got to keep in mind that even at the time the story is set in, right? It is set in the Cold War. I mean, Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. So, you can kind of understand a little bit more of the us versus them mentality. But yeah, you also understand that if Superman is standing right there in front of you, if he's just saved you, if his actions show over and over how much he cares about everybody, he saves people. You could see why people would be persuaded, even Metallo, who, you know, purports to hate him at the beginning of the story and throughout. So, all right. Up next, we have Blue Beetle number 8, written by Josh Trujillo. Adrian Gutierrez is the artist. Will Quintana on colors. Lucas Catoni on letters. Action-packed issue. A lot happens. We get one of the recent Beatles quits, Natita. She quits. And it's not bad enough that she gives up, right? She doesn't want to have the scarab anymore. She wants to return to Metropolis, return to her, I guess she was a DJ in Metropolis before. She wants her life to be simple. She wants to go back to being just Roma, not this Beetle and what have you. But the way she goes about it, she goes to Victoria Court and allows Victoria Court to have her scarab, which obviously – Jaime's not real happy about that, to say the least, because Victoria hasn't shown herself to be very trustworthy, to be honest. So what's going to happen with Jaime? What's going to happen with Dynasties? What the consequences of that choice might be? We'll have to wait and see. The other thing that's really interesting is we get a throwback to a villain from the Blue Beetle series that started back in the 80s, the Paris Cullen drawn, Len Wein written, with Overthrow showing back up, but this is actually Overthrow's son, and he's there trying to take out Victoria Cord as she's apparently used the scarab to create a new kind of security type robot called Pinnacle, and she's not going to charge anybody for it, but apparently there's only one. But she's supposed, you know, she's saying, yes, it has all these fail safes, protect human lives at all costs and what have you. But when Overthrow attacks, we see this Pinnacle robot or what have you kind of takes extreme measures. So maybe even Victoria Cord may be surprised by what she's created here. So a lot of moving parts, a lot of new things being established, and Ted Cord being rescued by Booster Gold and Jaime Reyes last time, but he doesn't show up here. And even at the press conference where Victoria Cord reveals this Pinnacle robot, people are asking, hey, where's your brother? We still don't know. That's still to be revealed as well. So a lot of moving parts. Josh Trujillo is doing a good job of juggling them and making sure every little plot thread has just a little bit of forward momentum. So we know it's not being forgotten about. So I'm really enjoying what's happening in Blue Beetle. The only thing that little nitpick, the Adrian Gutierrez art, I've talked about it before, man, when he first started on the first volume of Blue Beetle, his art was so clean, and it's not anymore. And again, it's just a personal preference for me that I prefer that cleaner style. I talk about it all the time. The backgrounds tend to be very light in this issue. There's a scene where Roma's telling Jaime and I can't remember who. What's the girl that plays Dynast?
Roma.
Or Roma is Xiomara. Xiomara is Dynastes. Roma is Natita. So anyway, when Roma is telling Xiomara and Jaime about how she just couldn't do it anymore and she wanted to get back to her life in Metropolis and how she asked Victoria to remove the beetle from her, like in those scenes, and it still does work with what they chose to do in the background, but the backgrounds in those panels are just monochromatic. It's just the entire background is blue, or the entire background is orange, or the entire background is purple. So not a lot of detail there, obviously. And they do switch up the color, which kind of helps to set the emotional tone of the panel. But the point is that when you do that and you don't have any detail, that ink splatter that Adrian Gutierrez is using, it's even more apparent, right? And I'm just not a fan of that. So anyway, I am enjoying this. I do feel like this the series is very much in keeping with the tone of the movie, which I really enjoyed. I wish more people had gone to see it and it had done better. But I am enjoying this, and I'm curious to see what happens next. Because like I said, Josh Trujillo really has a lot of different plot threads going on at the same time, and he's keeping them all moving. So what'd you think of it, Rocky?
Well, it's interesting because this is the first issue, and I know it's taken me 8 issues to do it, but this is the first issue where I actually feel that I'm slowly starting to get a handle on Natita Dynastes and Blue Beetle. So it's Roma, Xiomara, and Jaime, and I'm finally getting a handle on the names a little bit more. And I like that. I still haven't, admittedly, okay, it's Kaji Da is the Blue Beetle entity for Blue Beetle, and it's Nal Dar is the Beetle entity for Natita, and I'm not sure what the name is for Xiomara Dynastes. But so I'm still working on the names, and that's, I don't know if that's a fair criticism of me to say, because all these characters have their different beetles and their different colors. And so that's on me to sort of figure that out. I mean, in fairness, some people have made that criticism, but then how the hell people love the Green Lantern universe and you got an emotional spectrum there and everybody can rattle that crap off by heart. Why, what's wrong with Blue Beetle? There's fewer players. So, you know, it's not, I can't legitimately say that criticism with good conscience, because the fact is, this is actually as interesting to me as some of the mythologies in the Green Lantern universe. The writing, sometimes the pacing's been a little bit off for me, and the art's been off for me throughout the issues. But at the end of the day, I am really, what keeps pulling me back here to be continuing to have interest in this, and I buy the physical copies of this as well, I really get a sense that we're building from scratch a new mythology for Blue Beetle. We really are. We're at the ground floor here, and you know, I think a relatively good job's been done. I particularly like that all these characters have very different voices. I mean, Xiomara in particular is pissed off at Roma Natita for she feels like she traitor to Victoria Court. How could you give her your powers? They got different feelings about their powers. Natita doesn't want her powers. She's afraid of them. She doesn't want to see herself like a monster. This isn't like Power Rangers 2.0. These are, I should watch what I say. I don't collect Power Rangers, but I don't collect any Power Rangers comic, but I feel like each of these individual characters have their own voice. There's even a potential love interest with one of the aliens having the hots for Jaime here, and he's already got potential love interest already in the series. I like that Victoria Cord is a complicated villain. She's not really a villain. She's kind of an anti-hero. She kind of has her own agenda. The fact that she builds Pinnacle utilizing the technology that she gets from the Tita, from the Null Dar, which I think lies at the heart of the Pinnacle, machine that's created. And Overthrow, I'll be straight up, I've never heard of Overthrow before. I thought that was a new character. That just goes to show my lack of knowledge of the mythology. But I thought it worked really well. I agree with you, the backgrounds. I wish the backgrounds were a little bit more filled in, I guess. Although maybe the background when Adita's talking, they were trying to reinforce her sense of isolation and loneliness and fear. And they didn't want to, they wanted you to focus in on the character and they didn't want you to focus in. Maybe that was the artistic reason for that. So I can even maybe justify that. But again, I enjoyed the issue. Wasn't my favorite of the week, but again, it was an issue I enjoyed. And, you know, I'm getting pickier and pickier with what physical copies I buy, and I'm going to buy this one. So I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, Overthrow first appeared Blue Beetle number 15, August 1987. He also showed up in the Millennium event, which I know you read way back when, but not exactly.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
a heavily used character, so you're forgiven for not knowing. All right. So that does it for the books we're going to talk about in detail, everybody. There are a number of other single issues that are out this week. Blue Beetle 8 also has a Spanish edition. There's also Batman Scooby-Doo Mysteries Volume 3, number 4. There's also Scooby-Doo Where Are You, number 127. And then the Sandman 19 Remastered, which that Sandman 19 issue is sort of infamous. There was some sort of mistake when they first put it out, and all the copies had to be destroyed. But then there are some that are out there, and they're very expensive if you can find them on eBay or what have you.
I got two of them.
But the story itself, doesn't William Shakespeare show up in that story? And then it's a first appearance for somebody else, so it's kind of a well-known issue. I'm not surprised that DC's redoing it. I think there's a lot of people that probably don't have a copy and would like to have a copy. So yeah, kind of interesting, but it's not something that I was going to read because I still haven't read any Sandman, actually, which surprises some people. Some people yell at me when they find that out. But yeah, I still haven't read any Sandman, so I wasn't going to like jump in with issue 19. But anyway, that's out this week as well. And then as far as trades go, we have 100 Bullets, book one trade paperback, which this has been reprinted before. But this trade paperback collects the first 19 issues. It's nearly 500 pages. That's the Brian Azzarello, Eduardo Risso story, which is really, really fantastic. Also, Bad Dreams, a dreamer story, which when we had Nicole Maines on a few weeks ago, she was talking about that. That's in the YA line. That's out there as well. Also, Batman, The Brave and the Bold, Volume 1, The Winning Card trade paperback. So this is not reprinting all the stories from Batman, Brave and the Bold, just the Winning Card story, just the Tom King, Mitch Garrett story, which I think it took about seven or eight issues of Batman, Brave and the Bold before they finally all came out. So if you want to read just that story, you can pick that up. Cyborg Homecoming trade paperback is also out. This is the Morgan Hampton written series, which I really enjoyed. In fact, I ran into Morgan this weekend at WonderCon. Hopefully we'll have him on at some point to chat about it. That's out as well. Also, the JLA, the Grant Morrison version of JLA, and this is when you still had the Electric Blue Superman. It's getting a collection that collects the first 9 issues of JLA, plus the JLA annual, plus some other books that cross over with those. Rocky and I have both been enjoying the Sandman universe Nightmare Country, the different volumes of that. The latest iteration of that was The Glass House. It's getting a hardcover, which collects all 6 issues. We also really enjoyed the Spirit World 6-issue mini that came out recently, written by Alyssa Wong. That is getting its own collection. And then we've got The Unstoppable Doom Patrol from Dennis Culver, somebody else I ran into at WonderCon this weekend. He is really hoping to do more of Doom Patrol. I, for one, really hope he gets a chance. Or he's just waiting to get approval, basically. So it may depend on those trade paperback sales. So if you didn't get a chance to read that, absolutely fantastic Doom Patrol. Dennis Culver does an amazing job, genius level job of incorporating all the different eras, all the different ideas of Doom Patrol over the years, whether it's Flex Mentallo or different versions of Negative Man or Robot Man or what have you. Because there's been a lot of weirdness with Doom Patrol over the years.
Good series.
Yeah, whether it was Rachel Pollack or Grant Morrison or whomever. And the Chris Burnham art is fantastic. So really need those traits to sell well so we can get more of that. And then finally, Superman, Lois and Clark, number two, Doom Rising trade paperback. So this collects some stories from Action Comics 1051 to 1057, as well as from the Death of Superman 30th Anniversary Special. So, you know, originally the Superman, Lois and Clark was the Dan Jurgens written six-issue mini that had to do with the post-crisis pre-rebirth Superman, who was kind of hiding out. This is when there was actually two Supermen in the DC universe. He was kind of hiding out in Smallville, still doing things undercover as Superman, wearing the black costume. And then we got more of that version of Superman and Lois and a young John Kent as backup stories or co-feature, if you will, in when Philip Kenny Johnson's Action Comics run started. So that whole story where John Kent is sort of fooled, I guess you'd say, by an alien who has nefarious intentions, but he thinks he's helping save her. She kind of presents herself as a damsel in distress. So that's that story. It's written by Dan Jurgens, great art by Lee Weeks. So a ton of great collections this week. If you're so inclined, definitely recommend that Doom Patrol for sure. So, all right, Rocky, moment of truth. What do you have for your book of the week?
Yeah, my book of the week, I am going to go with, let me see here. It was tough, but I'm going to have to go with, if I can just find it here. Yes. I'm going to go with Birds of Prey. It was a tough one. It was a, you know, I loved Neil Before Zod was great. Poison Ivy was good. Batman 146 was good. But you know what? I enjoy the humor and the fun and my Pyrian fanboy instincts were kicked in. Big Barter naked. I mean, come on. I'll stop talking now. I'll just embarrass myself. But let's just say that it's just good comic book fun. And it ends on a cliffhanger. And I know it was the second issue of a setup, but it's a great setup. And I'm really curious to where it's going. And I had a lot of fun with it. And just honestly, it was just a really great week this week. I didn't dislike any of the comics. I think this is the first week I can honestly say that I got something out of every single comic I read. I mean, that's batting 100%. They were all good. This one just happened to be just slightly above the pack in my mind. What about yourself?
Yeah, pretty easy choice for me, actually. I'm going to go with Neil Before Zod. I just love everything that Joe Casey and Dan McDade are doing with Zod. Whether it's him giving up a little bit, whether it's him just blinded by anger, or whether it's him just saying, well, I've lost everything that tethered me to any sort of possible happiness for me, and I'm just going to be an out and out complete jackass, you know, going forward, evil villain. It doesn't matter. I don't care what the motivation is. They're nailing it with this series. The art's fantastic. Yeah, they've done a fantastic job of returning Zod to his villainous roots. So appreciate that. All right. Well, that's going to do it, everybody. Don't forget, if you're listening to us on the audio only feed, head over to YouTube, subscribe to Rocky's YouTube channel so you know when new content's coming out. Comic Space Boom! ! Is the name of the channel. Ring the notification bell, subscribe, leave a comment, let us know what you thought about the books this week. You can also head over on YouTube to the Comic Source YouTube channel where we do the daily Spawn, going through Spawn from start to finish, starting with Spawn 1, including crossovers and other minis and what have you. We're really enjoying it. We're getting a good community going over there, so we appreciate you guys giving us a follow. I'm trying to get to 500 subscribers over there so I can monetize and help pay for all this stuff that I do with comic stuff. I'm really close. I'm above 450, but I haven't hit that magical 500 number, so appreciate everybody's support. And also, if you're checking us out on YouTube and you want to listen to the audio-only content, the past couple thousand, I think somewhere around 2,500 episodes, that are on the Comic Source audio feed, just go to wherever you get your podcasts, whatever your favorite app or podcasting platform is, do a search for The Comic Source and subscribe. There's tons of great content over there and more content to come. As I mentioned, I ran into a lot of creators this weekend at WonderCon. A lot of people are like, hey, when am I coming back on? It's hard to make room for everybody. But I definitely love talking to creators, they love talking to me. So yeah, we'll have some good interviews coming up for you all, over the next few weeks. So that's going to do it for this episode. We appreciate the support as always, and we will talk to you next time.
Catch you later.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.